Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. This is Sadia Khan. It's me already. Are you kidding me? Seriously, guys, time is flying. I don't know, maybe it's me getting older and I notice the fleeting time more. Or maybe it's something else. I don't know. But seriously, time is going by so quickly. And it's really freaking me out. Anyways, today's episode is a fun one. So any gamers out there, this may be of interest to you especially. Now, most of you may have heard of Call of Duty. It's one of the most famous video games in the world, known for placing a player into a war zone with lifelike graphics and immersion.
The rules of engagement have changed.
Stand clear!
All stations on my mark. 3, 2, 1. Going dark.
It has a fan base of millions of gamers, and if you know anything about video games or Hollywood movies, you know, representation of non-white people can be racist and stereotypical. But today, I'm talking with two professors and authors from the University of Chicago, Ali Reza Dustar and Ghanwa Haik, who are working on this incredible new project, Gaming Islam.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Gaming Islam, a series of films about video games and their complicated relationship to Islam, Muslims, and the Middle East.
Where the two of them deconstruct, I already like this episode, Call of Duty and its depiction of Southwest Asian, North African, and Muslim individuals. Ali Reza is an associate professor of Islamic studies and the anthropology of religion. His work looks at how religious text and media can be linked to how people understand themselves. Ghanwa, an associate professor of modern Arabic literature, recently published a book called Beirut, Imagining the City, Space and Place in Lebanese Literature. Her current research focuses on the impact of immigration as well as expanding on our notions of diaspora. Guys, I am so excited to speak with them today about what they've learned through this project and how we can reimagine and reassert our identities in the most authentic way. So let's get started. Hello and welcome to Immigrantly, Ali Reza and Ghanwa. I'm really excited to be in this space with you. How are both of you doing?
Hello. Thanks for having us. I'm okay. I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having us. And sorry for my tech illiteracy.
No worries. You know, I just know the basics as well. I try to act as if I know everything. I don't. My sound designer is amazing, so he knows how to fix all the problems that I sent his way. Ali Reza, how are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you so much. And thank you for having us.
So, you know what's fascinating to me? I'm not a gamer. I've not played Call of Duty ever. And the fascinating thing about the work that you guys are doing, Gaming Islam, and we'll talk about it, is that it really deconstructs these stereotypical representations of minorities, especially Muslims, in video games, which honestly, I would not have thought of because I am so fixated on mainstream media, TV, films, podcasts, that I wasn't even thinking how problematic video games can be. You guys are gamers. You used to play games growing up, right?
We still play games.
Now we do it professionally.
How was that experience? Like as kids, were you aware of any stereotypical representation of Muslim identity, or were you just playing games for funsies?
Before we start, it's important to say that we are both very different kinds of gamers. And I imagine so even when we were young. So when I was young, I mostly played on a Game Boy and then eventually a Sega Mega Drive, on which I played platformers featuring hedgehogs, plumbers, none of the games I actually played as a young kid were the kinds of games that we're playing now and interested in playing now. So that's my end. Ali Riza?
Yeah, I also played a lot of different kinds of games. I think my first console was a TurboGrafx-16. And this is, it's a console that does not exist anymore. And I had that in the 90s. I think my favorite games and the ones that stayed with me the longest were on PC. And there were games I played as a kid that did have some of the stereotypical issues that we try to address in our series, including the original Prince of Persia. I played that as a kid.
I remember playing that.
You remember that?
Yeah.
We both just recently played the most recent iteration, which is Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, which is a fantastic game.
Our kingdom is cursed. The prince has been kidnapped and taken to a forbidden land. All hope rests with us, the immortals, to rescue him and save the empire. But we weren't prepared for what was coming next.
That original game, though, what I remember about it was, A, it was a lot of fun. B, it was kind of cool to be playing a game that seemed to in some way be about you or represent you and your culture, you know, being an Iranian myself. But then thirdly, I remember playing it and thinking, I don't know if any of this is really about Iran, or it's this kind of generalized Middle East Muslim-y thing, which you see in a lot of games, right? I wasn't thinking at the time about representation, but there were issues. The nefarious vizier who wants to kind of capture the princess, and then the prince is trying to save her, and you know, the sort of the style of dress of the scantily clad princess, and the vizier who looks like a sheikh, and you know, all of this kind of stuff. I guess it was part of my experience even growing up. I'll say also that this, I was playing this at this around the same time that Aladdin came out. So, and Aladdin similarly was a cartoon that was really huge in my imagination. I was memorized the entire script, like I could recite it with my brothers in the evening, and I knew all the songs, and yet I also knew it was really problematic.
It's so interesting and almost introspective for me, because when I think of Prince of Persia, I was just playing it as a game. As a child, I did not think about the problematic elements. And I grew up in Pakistan, so probably being part of the dominant population, being in Pakistan, I wasn't fully aware of how my identity played out on international stage. So for me, it was just a game. And I played it. I enjoyed it. I could somehow, in a very weird, almost messed up way, relate to it. But now when I look back, I can see how problematic it was or it is. Fast forward to now. How did this project get started, Gaming Islam? What were you two trying to uncover through it?
We had both reached a point in our careers where we were able to start imagining public outreach in a different way than in our usual academic context. So beyond the classroom, beyond the kind of scholarship that we were trained in and trained to produce. And we had both gotten back into gaming because of the pandemic mostly. And we started to have conversations about these things that we were noticing about games. And then I guess it just happened. We wrote a grant. We got the grant.
Yeah, just the two of us playing games and talking about games, but then thinking, wouldn't it be cool if we actually made something of this that wasn't just for our own entertainment? You know, maybe we can sort of embody the Professor Gamer persona, if such a thing exists, or if it doesn't exist, we create that.
Is there a particular reason you chose Call of Duty?
Foolishness. Hubris. It was very obvious when we started reading about these topics. It just would constantly come up. And it is the most popular gaming franchise of all time. We realized making the first videos, though, later, that maybe we bit off a bit more than we could chew.
How so?
There's so much in the game. And it was our first time making a video like the videos we made for Gaming Islam, the Call of Duty episode. And it was challenging.
Let's take a step back and explain what Gaming Islam is for listeners who don't know.
So Gaming Islam is a series of videos about the representations of Islam, Muslims, and the Middle East in video games. our starting point is the understanding that video games are a huge part of contemporary popular culture, that in terms of the size of the industry, it now dwarfs every other entertainment industry in the world, including Hollywood, including music, including some of the biggest sports industries. And so it's really not taken seriously enough, we think, within the scholarship and within kind of just public consciousness about popular culture. So just as an example, Call of Duty Modern Warfare, the version that we played, the 2019 version, made $1 billion in, what was it, a month, I think? And then the second one made $1 billion in just 10 days.
Oh, wow.
So these are really huge, and you have hundreds and hundreds of people working on them. You have years of research. And in the case of some of the shooter games like Call of Duty, you have the military, the American military in particular, being interested in using them as recruitment. So they're really important for multiple reasons. So yeah, that was the really genesis of the project, was our recognition of how important this is, and also how much we ourselves enjoy both playing and thinking about games. So we wanted to kind of combine that and really spread the maybe both the excitement and the critical perspective on gaming.
Before we delve into Call of Duty and some of the problematic elements, has the experience, the gaming experience, changed for both of you? Because now it's more an inquiry into how these games are structured and what are some of the problematic elements versus just a game, right?
I'm a literary scholar by training. And so for me as well, it's very similar to kind of reading for pleasure, which is something that is separate from reading for work. And so I think I came in with that muscle already practiced. And I always try to play the first time without thinking critically about the text, in this case, the game. And then sort of a second play over or through discussions or through reading more and researching, I start sort of exploring the critical dimensions. So I guess it hasn't really changed a lot. And there are many games that I just play for fun.
Yeah, I also have been playing for fun. Most recently, I've been playing Grand Theft Auto 5 and also Gris, which I learned from a conversation with Renoir, which is a really fantastic game. Two completely different games. But I think something that has changed for me is that I've been paying more attention, as you said, to gameplay elements and not just representation. The representation I think about all the time. It's just kind of like as Renoir said, it's just like a muscle. But I think the gameplay was not something that I was so reflective on before I started actually thinking about it with Renoir in this more systematic way. So for instance, the fact that when you play Grand Theft Auto, which is not about the Middle East, at least not the version that I'm playing, you know, it kind of unleashes your what Freud called the id, you know, just your drives for pleasure and for kind of for also aggressiveness. And it just allows you to do whatever you want. And there's really no repercussions for anything you do, right? So like, how is it that the game enables that? And then what kind of pleasure and joy you take as a gamer in that? It was something that I don't think I would have maybe paid as much attention to if it wasn't as part of an actual project.
That's quite interesting, because from what I'm hearing, you're saying that these games are addictive in a way, right?
I mean, that's the principle of their success is, you know, they have to be addictive to keep you playing and to keep you wanting to play the next version and then buy the next game.
And I wonder, on the one hand, we see addictive nature of these games. And on the other hand, we see these problematic depictions of Muslim identity, and you combine the two and you have a recipe for disaster. Right? Because somebody is watching them again and again, and it's almost reimagining or reorienting yourself to a particular identity in a very reductive, one-dimensional fashion.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely that. I think what's intriguing to me about video games in particular is that it's the self that is being reoriented is much closer to yourself than in a more abstract way when you're watching a movie, or a more passive way when you're watching a movie. Like, I find it fascinating that when you're playing a character in a game, you describe it as you. I died. I'm having a hard time killing this boss on level 6, for example, or whatever. So there's a collapse of the subject, which, to go back to your question or the comment that you brought up, I mean, it makes this orientation towards the other even more problematic.
in analyzing this particular game, one thing that both of you point out too is how the developers create fictional places based on real life locations or fictional objects based on real life objects. For instance, the flag they design in the game is borrowed imagery from real life flags like the ISIS. What similarities do you see in these video games to real life? And what is the reimagined part?
I think we have to ask what similarities maybe the directors were noticing, and that's partly what our task is. The kind of reimagination that the producers of this game are doing, part of our work is to show that that reimagination is problematic, and it's because their perceptions are problematic, right? So for instance, it's a very common trope within representations of the Middle East that all of the Middle East is the same. And that same is topographically the same. It's very often sand dunes and deserts and oases and palm trees. You'll never see a ski resort in a representation of the Middle East, even though those exist. You don't see lush forests. How often do you see beaches in the representation of the Middle East? So, you know, that's one. It's like all of it is the same, whereas this is a vast region with many different topographies and climates and so on. But then the other is that the people are all the same, right? So here we have a kind of a mishmash between Arabic speakers from the Levant, right? So Syrians and Lebanese and Palestinians. It's like not only a kind of a combination of all of those into one category, but also mishmash between those Levantine peoples and then people from the Caucasus, from Central Asia. So it's like all of that, just like Muslim becomes just one broad thing. So that's in the imagination. What is similar is I think they do a pretty good job in this recent version of depicting certain things, like, for instance, the interior of a Syrian household. There's a scene in the game that we don't really talk about in the video so much, maybe just a brief mention, which does a nice job of depicting like what the wall art might look like, for instance, or what the furniture might be like. Or, you know, street signs are done a lot better than some of the earlier versions of Call of Duty. The language, some of the people who speak it, including Claudia Dumit, you know, she's a native Lebanese speaker, so she actually does a really good job. And a lot of the other characters do so as well. But yeah, but it's really the disconnect between, I think, what is recognizably Middle Easterner and what isn't. And then the way that those sometimes get twisted. So just as an example, the Uruzgan rebels in the game, Uruzgan is the fictional country that a lot of the game is based in. The Uruzgan rebels are modeled after Kurdish rebels.
Mm.
And it's easy to identify them as good because Kurdish rebels, at least in the fight against ISIS, have developed this image in the Western imagination as the good Middle Easterners, maybe even not Middle Easterners. I don't know, like what, you know, how are Kurds typically even imagined? Or do people think Kurds are Middle Easterners? I don't know. So it's like the good characters become the Kurds and then the bad characters become the ones who look like Arabs in the sense of ISIS, right? So there's that sort of nefarious, I think, juxtaposition, but also discrepancy between how one group is represented versus another.
There's a very realistic borrowing from actual political events and events that are linked to specific conflict that, again, are both depicted very accurately in the sense of their visual representation. So there are images that come out of the civil war in Syria of like people in white helmets pulling children out of rubble of their homes. And those kind of match almost shot for shot to images from the Syrian war. As does, for example, the imagery of the highway of death. Except in both cases, what is happening is a kind of displacement where the people perpetrating the atrocity are not the people linked to that atrocity in actual history.
Hmm.
So you have a very real scene that is detached from its historical reality and attached to the kind of new reality that the game wants you to learn or to have.
And of course, that new reality is a reality that serves an American imperial consciousness of the world, right? It's a reality where it's Russians who are bad guys first and foremost, and then it's Arab terrorists who are bad guys secondly, or somewhere on the same order, right? And Americans and British are a force for good, even if there are some bad eggs among them, and even if there are some people or some organizations that are power hungry. But ultimately, the source of good in the world lies with the Western militaries.
Exactly. I was, in fact, going to say, if we can safely assume that this game can be characterized as a propaganda tool and recruitment tool for American military, because from what you are telling me, there is this juxtaposition of reality and accurate depiction with reimagined world. And the reimagined world is basically some of the stereotypical elements that are perpetuated within American social and political discourse, right? Developers or producers, whoever they are cherry picking what makes sense in the broader conversation around Muslim identity and Middle Eastern politics and society, right?
100%. The game is a recruitment tool. It is enabled in some ways by close connections with the military. The development studio has a not-for-profit called Project Code, I think.
That sounds suspicious.
Well, it integrates ex-veterans or veterans, I guess, into sort of coding as a way out of the military.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they're very close ties.
This is a good segue into representation of women, either facilitators or working on the periphery, helping US military, or being part of ISIS or terrorists. And you talk about Kurdish representation in these games, and you've discussed this in your videos, is there's this clear dichotomy between Kurdish woman with a loose head covering who is obviously on the side of the military. And then there are Muslim women wearing hijab who are squarely located in terrorist camps that players invade. What variation have you seen when it comes to representation of Muslim women, and what does it really imply?
It's actually interesting developmentally to think about the version of Call of Duty that we played compared to some of the older ones. In some of the older ones, if there is a Middle Eastern character who is an actual character, who has a name, has a persona, has a story, they're just negative characters, right? There are no positive Muslim / Middle Eastern characters. And these are also the games where the representations are least smart, I would say, or most problematic. So there is an actual one that's based in Pakistan, and the signs are all in Arabic. And then you also have signs that are in Arabic, but they're also backwards. Yeah. Kumail Nanjiani has a skit about this, actually.
So I was going to go get it, but then I found out that the newest Call of Duty has a level in it called Karachi, which is the name of a city in Pakistan, the city I grew up in. Yeah, that's very weird for me. They're like, your hometown is now a battlefield. How many points can you get? So I was going to go buy it again, but then I found, okay, so the language you speak in Pakistan is Urdu. That's the name of the language you speak. It's called Urdu. But all the street signs in Karachi in Call of Duty are in Arabic, which is a totally different language. And I know it doesn't seem like a big deal, but this game took 3 years to make. If you look at it, they get every detail perfect, like the graphics. You can see individual hair on people's heads. When they run, they sweat. When they run, their shoelaces bounce. All they had to do was Google Pakistan language.
I mean, let me say, I'm a native Arabic speaker, and it is offensive when I see these signs that are detached and then backwards Arabic, because no one writes Arabic. So they're equal opportunity offenders.
Yeah.
You know, they should hire us.
So recently, this is actually why they got better, is because they started hiring experts, and they started hiring people who actually know the languages and know the cultures. And sometimes this happens in games that are politically not so bad, right? So like Assassin's Creed Mirage, the most recent game, has a beautiful representation of Baghdad in the, what is it, the 10th century. And they consulted historians, and they consulted people who are designers and actors and speakers from Arabic-speaking and Persian-speaking backgrounds. And they ended up creating a really beautiful and really thoughtful, I think, depiction of Baghdad. So it can work in good ways. But I think in Call of Duty, what happens is they have gotten better at the representation, but they haven't gotten better at the politics. because they're using the good representation in the sense of more accurate or more, say, sophisticated towards nefarious ends. And the gender thing is one of them, right? So you have this good Muslim versus bad Muslim thing going on, where it's very clearly set up in such a way that it ends up serving a particular American narrative about the version of Islam and the version of Muslims who are to be trusted and who are morally good are the ones who work with us, right? And that has a, as you said, it has a very clear, or a mostly clear, I should say, breakdown in terms of gender representation. The ones who have the full hijab are the ones who are on the side of the bad guys. Not always. I mean, there are quote unquote terrorist figures whose wives are uncovered completely, like the butcher character is one of those. But then the ones who look like they're wearing Kurdish headdresses, they're the ones who are the good rebels.
Alireza, you mentioned accurate representation in terms of geography and the architecture. What worries me about that, the more accurate the representation gets, the more palatable narrative becomes, right? So if the depiction is more accurate, like you and I can criticize the depiction and we can make fun of how they don't know what language is spoken in Pakistan or Iran for that matter. But as they improve skills of representation, then it becomes more realistic for people to connect the dots and say, oh yeah, you know, they are pretty good at representing it visually. So the politics and the narrative side must be accurate as well. Do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right. But there is pushback, and the pushback is coming not just from players, but also game developers. Because what's been happening in the past decade or two is that increasingly people from Muslim backgrounds, from Middle Eastern backgrounds, from South Asian backgrounds, they're entering the game development world itself and the industry itself. And they now have more of a say. And they're talking not just about representation, right? Are we represented accurately or not? But also how the games are depicting things. What kind of politics is it serving? And I think that's critical. And that's partly what we're trying to do on our own smaller scale, right, with our video series, is to help people think critically about these things.
Is there anything that surprised both of you watching and analyzing those games from a different lens?
You know, the thing I didn't expect was how much I enjoyed playing Call of Duty. When Alireza suggested it, I was like, first-person shooter. I don't play first-person shooter. Its politics are awful, blah, blah. And then I just could not stop. I was just like, you know, one chapter after the other. So then, you know, when I stepped back critically and took some distance, I think there's something really sort of fascinating about the narrative structure that pulls you into these games that I wasn't considering. It's sort of the parallel to what Alireza was saying about gameplay, but in the sense of narrative, right? I noticed like how sophisticated the narrative construction is of these stories in a way that I wasn't expecting. And now I watch out for in some ways.
I wonder if it has anything to do with the morality of it all. You're the player. You are the good guy. Does that fuel how exciting the game becomes? Because then you're the saviors in a way.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it quite in those terms, because I think it's also possible, like my Grand Theft Auto example, to be very, very bad and still enjoy the game. It's partly about the ability maybe to put yourself in different shoes than what you are and to try out a different kind of perspective. So maybe, in fact, what is appealing about it is that you can say, let me try out what it feels like to be an American soldier, maybe. You know, I remember I was in Sana'a in Yemen, the capital of Yemen, back in 2007, and there were all these gaming cafes, and a lot of the kids were playing Call of Duty or similar shooter games. And I remember thinking to myself, what are all these, you know, young Arab men mostly, who are the subject of so much U.S. imperialistic terror, frankly, what are they doing playing these games? And I'm sure the kind of work it does for them is very different. I don't know that you play this game in Yemen and then you end up buying into an American imperial narrative.
Yeah.
Maybe you do. I mean, that's a question, right? But I think maybe part of it is about just trying out. What does it feel like? You know, what does it mean? How would it be to try out to inhabit a story from an American perspective, even if you end up mocking it, even if you end up realizing how stupid it is, you know, it's fun to try.
You're absolutely right. And in these games, there are so many disturbing scenes of torture and killing, good versus bad. And I wonder how that impacts players' perceptions around morality of war. How moral is war?
I mean, this is an incredibly violent game that is in many ways kind of encapsulated within a sort of perspective that Aliriza was describing, right? Like a moral spectrum where you are the good. In a very unsubtle way, it asks you to reflect on the morality of violence and the sort of lack of morality of people who deploy violence who are your enemies compared to you, right? As the good person, the lovable rogue or whatever it is, whatever character you're playing. I also wanted to sort of point out that for most people experiencing Call of Duty, they're playing multiplayer mode. So it's a different kind of sociality. It's a different kind of story even. It's much less narratively connected or threaded. It's just basically a free-for-all where you and your friends are just basically shooting either each other or a group of other groups of friends. So it's a kind of sociality of violence, unlike the sort of, and we kind of were not so interested in that. We were interested in the story itself that the developers wanted to tell, in the narrative, in the sort of, in the thread that they wove for you if you were just playing as a single player. But that is very much a sort of exceptional way of playing it in some ways, because the vast majority of these games, consumers do not play it like that. In some ways, they play it in a completely kind of like amoral space where they're just murdering each other.
So you think when they are playing in that amoral space, they are not consciously seeing themselves as good or bad?
I think it's what it is it's a kind of a competition, right? So you're given a mission and then you're supposed to carry out that mission. That mission might be to secure some, like a nuclear facility, or it might be to capture a lot of money that is being dropped by helicopters, or it might be to just take out your enemy. Either there is a little bit of a story to it or there isn't a story, but it's the ultimate point is to win. And I think even in the narrative version, what's maybe nefarious about the way violence is represented is from the American and British perspective that you inhabit, right? A war is happening, and then you enter it because you have to. It's Americans go in there because there's violence that's taking place and they want to control it, right? They want to bring peace back, or they want to stop the terrorists, right? It's not that they're going out there because they want to serve American interests or they want to secure American geopolitical power.
Yeah, but then they do it by partaking in violence.
Exactly.
Right. But so it's necessary violence.
It's necessary. So where the moral thinking comes in is not about initiating the war. It's not about, was this war a moral war at all, right? What is maybe the space for thinking is this particular act that I'm doing, like shooting a civilian or deciding whether to threaten the wife of a so-called terrorist, are those moral or not? And even there, the game tries to say, well, war is complicated. Sometimes, what is the word? You have to crack some eggs to make an omelet, right? And that means sometimes you have to go beyond just the moral prescriptions that we think. And that's where the game tries to get a little bit edgy, right? It's like, well, how can you stop terrorists if you're not willing to go beyond what is allowable in the law or in even just basic human decency?
So is it safe to say that the game is reimagining the concept of morality in a way? What is moral? Violence, if, you know, used for a particular goal or for greater good, is okay?
I mean, I wouldn't say that it's reimagining that. It is continuing in a long tradition of cultural production that mobilizes violence for pleasure in particular ways, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
It's just doing it in a different genre or a new, it's using the language and tools of its genre to tell us this story. I mean, it's, think about Top Gun.
What the hell? Good morning, aviators. This is your captain speaking.
That is also similarly the story of a rogue who is super well-trained and like, serves the U.S. Army, right?
He's somebody that you want to be.
Exactly.
And that to me is so problematic.
Yes, but it's not. But it's not differently problematic than in a movie like Top Gun.
How we are consuming American pop culture is also similar, but this, I guess, is more concentrated, more violent. And as you said, it's almost separating subject from the player who's playing it, right? So it's almost like you're playing that game. You become the person doing all of that. While in the case of Top Gun, I'm looking at Tom Cruise and I see Tom Cruise playing this character. Obviously, I can't distinguish myself from him. I may project my morality on him, but I am not him.
Right. And I would also say that most people who watch Top Gun are not projecting morality on Tom Cruise's character. They're just really enjoying the sort of action, right? I mean, that's what action movies are. They're kind of mindless entertainment. And I'm sure the young men in Yemen that Ali Reza was just talking about would have also loved Top Gun or watched Top Gun.
What do you think can be done to create accurate representation and imagined realities in a way where we are being true to what's happening, and not just what's happening now, but true to history as well?
Well, I mean, at a very basic and banal level, I think more people need to be in the game, so to speak, right? More people need to be telling stories. More people need to be creating characters and contributing to the creation of games. I think the biggest roadblock is not that there is any shortage of talent or there's any shortage of interest, is that there's shortage of money. So where the big corporations that produce the biggest games and have the biggest impact in the world are the ones that are not really interested in telling stories that would be challenging to some of these dominant narratives. Frankly, not necessarily just because they want to serve US interests or whatever, although that's definitely a part of it. Like, you know, with this game in particular, it's a very strong part of it. But also because I think that what they think about ultimately is, are they going to sell or not? And is a critical, sophisticated perspective going to sell more than one that is just relishing in violence and misogyny or sort of, you know, slightly reworks things so that now it's women doing the killing rather than the men? So it's a tough battle, but I think there's no other way than just people who are both creative and have the right political and moral sensibilities to themselves be making games.
But there are also beautiful, I mean, games that are independent and try to tell stories of other kinds of characters. So, for example, I often assign in one of my classes a game called Bury Me My Love, where you play as the husband of a woman from Syria who's trying to leave Syria as a migrant.
Mm.
And you're helping her make decisions. Like, should I bribe the boatman or should I, you know, take the bus? And as she tries to make her way across Europe without papers to join you.
Hmm.
It's a story that is based on an interactive media piece, a piece of investigative journalism that then became a game. And it tries to tell a very sophisticated story and it has many different endings. So you can die and you can make it to Sweden, I think, and get asylum.
Hmm.
And there's 40 other options in the middle.
We should maybe mention the game that we're making a video about now, Heaven's Vault.
History is a science. It's the reconstruction of the past. I'm an archaeologist. I dig stuff up. Every ancient inscription I decipher is a piece of the puzzle.
Which is very interesting because it has nothing of the nefarious kind of empire-serving content or narrative of Call of Duty. And it does a lot of things that are quite fascinating. Like, its main protagonist is a woman who wears hijab, and her name is Alia Al-Asra, so she has an Arabic-sounding name. And yet it has issues. Like, we're trying to think about and ask our audience whether they think this is ultimately an Orientalist depiction, in the sense that there are certain kind of stereotypical ways in which the East, quote unquote, and especially the Middle East is imagined, and whether that ends up being the central foil of this, even though it's a futuristic game that's based on an entirely different planet. So it's not supposed to be the Middle East, and yet Middle Eastern figures and characters make it into it. So, you know, I would just say not all games are the same, and there's ways that games do try to be very critical. And we just have to also maintain our critical sensibilities towards them.
Yeah, I mean, talking about games and TV and movies, I just recently watched Dune, and we could do a whole episode on that. But in the end, if you were to define United States of America in the context of gaming, how would you do that?
Oh, that's a hard one.
We need a full episode for that. I'm going to let Lenoa have the smarter answer here, but I'll say that we actually haven't been thinking all that much about kind of where the geographic placement of the companies that make these games are, like, and tie them to particular national cultures. I think with Call of Duty, it's pretty clear, even though a lot of it is sort of, you know, that there are British characters and the British armed forces are a central part of this. But I think there's a certain way that gaming has become so globalized. You know, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are now pouring billions and billions of dollars into gaming. And is that necessarily going to improve the way Muslims are represented? You know, and maybe or maybe not, right? I mean, I think it's more complicated than just what the national culture of, or, you know, even if there is such a thing, of the particular gaming company is. So I think there's something about this and the global, both the global talent that goes into the making of games and the global audience that's anticipated, right? So when Activision, say, is producing Call of Duty, they want to sell this everywhere and not just in the US. So I think it's a really complicated set of issues to pick apart.
I do not have a smarter answer.
You know, this was so good. And I am so glad that you guys are doing this incredible work. So for listeners, where can they find your analysis, your commentary on these games? Is there a website? Is there a YouTube channel they can go and follow?
Yes, we have a YouTube channel. And you can find us at Video Gaming Islam.
Video Gaming Islam, right. Or you can search Gaming Islam on YouTube, and at first you'll get a lot of sheikhs asking if gaming is halal or haram. And then if you scroll down far enough, you'll find our videos.
You know what? After talking to both of you, I am going to play Call of Duty and I'm going to see it for myself.
Yes.
I've read about it as we were doing research for this interview. I must experience the game itself.
You must. We absolutely must.
Thank you, guys. This was so good. Thank you for coming on my show. It was wonderful.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
So I am going to play Call of Duty just to experience what it really entails. I really enjoyed this conversation. First, I wasn't aware how popular gaming is, which is a bit crazy. I should have been. But also how sometimes gaming itself can be problematic and it can perpetuate certain stereotypes about identities and people. So next time, if you are a gamer, be mindful of what you are playing. Enjoy the game, but don't fall for all the reductive, problematic, nefarious narrative that goes with it. This episode is produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by Bobak Afshari and me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer for this episode is Hazik Ahmed Farid. Theme music for Immigrantly is done by Simon Hutchinson. Come back next week when we have another fun story for you. Take care.